Good morning. We are about to proceed. I'd like the marshal to call the case, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. Calling the case of A20-1397, Paul Nelson versus Lawrence Nelson.
Good morning again, and thank you for participating remotely today. And although we are not in person, but we'll proceed under the same rules as if we were in the Judicial Center. The proceedings are being audio recorded, so please state your name and the party that you represent before you begin your argument. And because, as you know, we're using this video conferencing platform, we understand that there may be interruptions, pets and doorbells, family members. We hope to keep these to a minimum, but do understand that these things can happen. I also want to alert you to the difference between gallery view and active speaker view. The marshal will be sharing a screen that shows your clock. If you're in the gallery view, then we're all everybody's picture is a little smaller, including that clock, and you might not be able to read it. So if you, if you're in active speaker view, let me say that again. If you're in active speaker view, only the active speaker will be shown, and everybody else will be small, including the clock. So you want to make sure you're in gallery view, and that way each of the screens will be a little bit larger, including the clock, and you'll be able to read that and know how much time is remaining for your argument. I want to say one other thing, and that is if you are not able to hear us or see us, let us know right away. Only the judges and the attorneys are permitted to speak, and so we have disabled the ability of other participants to share their audio and video or to make comments in the chat function. And with that, if counsel's prepared to proceed, counsel for appellant, are you prepared?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, John Mack for appellants. First, I'd like to start out by apologizing to the court. I'm a little woozy because I got my second COVID yesterday, so I'm trying to be as clear-headed as I possibly can. I'd like to start out by saying, take this case from Norma Nelson's position. Norma Nelson wrote a will in which all her children had some sort of legacy. The cabin, which is the largest single item of the legacy, did go to Lawrence.
Mr. Mack, I'm sorry to interrupt. I think Mr. Storm, if you're not muted, we can hear typing, and it might be yours. I'm not sure, but it looks like you're, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Mack.
Did that help?
That did, thank you.
Norma Nelson wanted all her children to obtain some legacy. When she did this, she gave the bulk of the cabin, which appeared to be the most valuable to Lawrence and Robert, but gave other valuable assets to her other children. One of the basic problems with this case, in fact, I think perhaps the basic problem with the case, is that no one consulted Norma Nelson as to how the problems with the distribution and the payment for her upkeep should be handled. For example, Lawrence and Robert had several options to make sure that the will of Norma Nelson was carried out. Rather than simply use the cabin for their own benefit and for storage without rent, they could have done the following. They could have, for example, sold the cabin. That would have allowed either Lawrence or Robert or both of them to purchase the cabin. And if they had done so, there would have been more than enough money in the estate to handle all the needs of Norma Nelson.
Let me stop you, Mr. Mack. I want to make sure that I understand the real issue before this court. As I look at the record, the complaint asserted a claim for an accounting and a claim that the respondents breached fiduciary duty they owed to Norma Nelson. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
And the accounting claim, as I understand it, is gone. So we're just, the only remaining claim in the complaint against these respondents has to do with the breach of the fiduciary duty owed to Norma.
That's true.
Okay. And just because there's some procedural mess, that I think the relief you're asking for is the opportunity to have a jury trial on that breach of fiduciary duty claim, correct?
True. Either a jury trial or a trial by court.
Okay. And so to the extent you asked, brought a motion for a new trial, that may have told your appeal period with respect to the summary judgment, but it there wasn't a trial that you needed a new trial on because the trial concerned Paul Nelson's claims, correct?
That's true. The interesting question, and I thought about this a lot, is the relief we would have requested would have been a trial for us. And so the rule simply says that you have 30 days to move for new trial. We did. There had been an old trial. It hadn't concerned us, but that doesn't matter. We followed the rule and we made our motion within 30 days. And of course, the court below had not issued an order saying there was no just reason for delay. So there's no way we could have appealed the summary judgment motion.
So we're really left here on considering whether there were genuine issues of material fact with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty claim. Is that right?
That's true.
So what? Tell me where in the record there is evidence that the respondents breached a fiduciary duty they owed to Norma Nelson.
Okay. First of all, there is, of course, the will that indicates that Norma Nelson wanted much of the property to go to my clients, with just the cabin going to the defendants in this case. So that's in the record, and the will is in the record, and the will indicate that she wanted reasonably equitable treatment. Now, there's an interesting case here called Harris v. Gellerman, which is not published yet. I wouldn't be surprised if it does get published, but it was January 25th, 2021 Westlaw 232866, which indicated that in the case of a guardianship, there is a duty to consult the ward before making a determination that specific acts should be done or not done. I submit that that case, while it isn't directly in point because it relates to a guardianship, relates to a fiduciary duty under a power of attorney as well, because the cases are clear that there is a fiduciary duty to the attorneys in fact, and that runs to the principal, in this case, Norma Nelson. And if it's true, and it certainly should be, that if the principal is competent, she needs to be at least consulted as to how to handle the various problems so that she can have her will, as indicated in her last will and testament, effectuated. Nobody asked her. In fact, as far as I can tell from the record, nobody asked her guardian. What does she want to do? Because here are the options that were available to Lawrence and Robert to make sure that her wishes were carried out and that my clients received some of the legacy. They could have sold the cabin and bought the cabin if they wanted to. They could have taken out a much larger loan, which would have, of course, allowed them to have monies for the payment of Norma Nelson's.
Mr. Mack, when I look at the will, and if to the extent the will indicates Norma Nelson's wishes, I mean, the will makes three specific devices, the payments to the theater and to the church, and then the gifting of the cabin to the two respondents. And only after that is there a general grant to the remaining siblings of the remainder of the estate. Is that accurate?
That's true.
All right. So where in the will does it require respondents as attorneys in fact to sell and or rent out a gift that was specifically given to them in the will?
The answer to that is that the residuary legatees were entitled to a reasonable share of the entire estate. And therefore, there was a duty as attorneys in fact, and this is the nature of the issue, to consult Norma Nelson to determine how she wanted to do it. Did she want to do it so that they got the cabin and nobody got anything else? Did she want them to sell so that somebody would have something and allow them to buy in? This is really an attorney in fact power of attorney issue, at least as much as the legatee issue. And basically what we're contending is that the defendants in this case ran the Norman Elson estate in such a way that it was entirely to their own advantage. When they had an opportunity to consult her, to determine what she wanted to do and to be fair. And in this case, they did some other rather minor things that are similarly unfair. For example, they used the cabin during the period of time when the attorney, in fact,
Let me redirect you. I mean, the cabin was given to the respondents in the will. I think that's pretty clear. That wasn't given to the other children.
Yes.
So, and as I understand the record, the respondents disposed of other assets, at least in part, to pay for Norma's medical care or and cost of living, didn't they?
Of course, and that's my
point. Isn't that a reasonable, wouldn't that be a reasonable exercise of their duties as attorneys, in fact?
If, but only if, they had consulted Norma and Norma had said, yes, go ahead and sell these assets rather than do something with the cabin, which might be able to afford her medical care as well. Getting to the minor issues in this thing, because I think this relates to the broader issue of using the power of attorney to their own advantage. The respondents in this case, for example, used the cabin for storage and didn't pay any rent. They used it to have parties with their friends and didn't pay any rent until the final.
If I could stop you there, sure. You know, the cabin was going to be going to Lawrence and Robert. So did they have to wait until Norma died before they could actually enjoy its use? Wouldn't they be able to enjoy its use in the meantime?
Sure they could, but they'd have to pay for it.
Why would they have to pay for something that they're going to own outright at some point in the future?
Well, first of all, we don't know if they're going to own outright anyway. Because
why not?
Well, for one thing, we don't know about the situation relative to Norma's competency. She could have another will. So we don't know for sure that Robert and his brother are going to be getting the cabin. Norma has the right to change her mind as long as she's minimally competent.
Okay, but even if that's true, why wouldn't they be able to enjoy the cabin? Are they required to just let it lay fallow and not be used at all during that period? That seems a rather odd requirement
that's
to make of our children.
Arguing. I'm arguing that they have the right to use the cabin, they have the right to enjoy the cabin, but that's an asset of Norman Nelson, and they have to pay reasonable rent for it.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that either they or any of the other siblings, in order to use the cabin, had to pay rent to Norma?
Yes, there is. There is an indication that a certain amount was to be charged, including charged for my clients, to utilize the cabin during the summer months.
By whom?
Where's that in the record? I'm
Pardon?
Sorry.
Yeah. By whom and where specifically in the record is that?
I think that's in the testimony by deposition of both Robert and Larry. And I think it's, in fact, argued before the court that Larry and his brother had decided that they were going to charge my client certain amounts for using it, or if the public was going to use it, they were going to charge them a certain amount per rent.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that it had been used as a rental property at any time?
That I'm not sure of. I wish I could answer that question, but I don't think the issue ever came up.
And the reason why I asked that is I couldn't find anything in the record on that. Why would it be expected that it actually be used as rental property? I mean, as a practical matter, I think most cabins are used for the enjoyment of the family. Or friends?
Yes, I think the answer to that too is that it wasn't until the guardianship and the attorney, in fact, relationship came into being that any duty came to utilize the property for the purpose of generating money. But once Robert and Larry became attorneys, in fact, their duties changed. It wasn't as if they were just family and they came there casually during the summer. Now they had a duty to maximize the estate of Norman Elson, and they didn't do it.
But can you cite, I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Brokman.
Is somebody?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. This will be my final question here, I think. Can you cite any case law requiring a party to rent out a cabin, having that type of duty that you're arguing was imposed on them?
I don't know if I could specifically point to a cabin. I think that there are cases, which unfortunately I can't cite right now, indicating that there is a duty to use the property of the estate to maximize the value to either the ward or, in this case, the principal. One of the things that I notice about this case is not only is there nothing from Norma indicating how the attorneys in fact should proceed, there's nothing from the guardian, which may in fact be even more important, because we know that assets are being dealt with. We know that there's a problem between Larry and Robert on the one hand and my clients on the other during the time that the power of attorney is being utilized. For example, my clients wanted to be there during the summer. They wanted to have a use of the cabin, and they were forbidden to do it. And this made them very angry. For these reasons, we think that the case should be reversed and remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. Mr. Storm, you may proceed.
I think Mr. Storm is muted to me. I don't know why.
Yep, Mr. Storm, I think you are still muted. Sorry about that.
Are you able to hear me now?
Now we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I actually have a telephone line connected, and I also have an internet connection to the court. My name is Paul Storm. I am the attorney representing Robert and Lawrence Nelson. They are the respondents in this case. They were defendants in the underlying district decision. In our brief that we provided to the court, we noted that there are two general categories of obstacles that exist for the appellants with respect to this request for a motion for new trial. One of those aspects has to do with procedural issues, and the other has to do with substantive. Judge Bjorkman, you already made a point to note that this is really a question at this point about one of the claims, the breach of fiduciary duty claim. The accounting claim, it appears, is not being contested, even though it was indicated in the original motion for appeal. So my understanding is that's the only topic that we're really addressing today. But the first general category that we pointed out in our brief is that a motion for new trial is not the appropriate relief in this matter. A motion for new trial necessarily requires that there was a trial in the underlying case. That breach of fiduciary duty claim was never actually put in front of the court on trial. It was decided on summary judgment. Now, the Court of Appeals has previously been confronted with exactly the circumstance of a summary judgment where someone has attempted to get a motion for new trial. That was the decision of Kassan versus Kassan. That's a decision from the Court of Appeals in 1987. It's included in our brief.
Mr. Storm, I don't disagree with you, but there's a much more recent decision out of our Supreme Court, Madsen versus Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, that seems to suggest that as long as a tolling motion is, or a motion is made that is one of the listed tolling motions, and a motion for a new trial is a listed tolling motion, then appellate rule 104.01 would permit an appeal under the circumstances here, that in fact the summary judgment would not be final until after that tolling motion were resolved. Is there a reason we shouldn't follow the Madsen case and hear the essentially the challenge to summary judgment on its merits?
I think that considering the summary judgment is still appropriate, one of the points that I wanted to pull from the Kaysen decision is that in that instance, the court noted that it was important for them to look at the summary judgment merits as well and ensure that, at least in that case, no further frivolous litigation was pursued. And one of the things that we note in the brief that was submitted by the appellants is that that brief, and by which I mean the brief that was submitted in support of a motion for new trial in the district court, that brief had two general rationales for why it was being brought. One of those two rationales was whether or not it would be necessary to bring a motion for new trial to preserve summary judgment, indicating that a subsequent appeal might come to this court regarding the summary judgment motion. Kaysen noted that we can just dispose of everything now. We can consider that, and there's no need to leave the door open for a subsequent motion. And I think that would be appropriate, especially in light of what type of briefing this court has in front of it. So that brings us to the merits of the summary judgment. That's where I'd like to focus.
Are you then conceding that we should be addressing the merits?
I believe that the merits were brought up when the lower court, when the district court looked at the motion for new trial, they noted that what was really happening was a motion for reconsideration.
Right. So what is your position today? Are you now conceding that we can consider? I'm sorry, Mr. Mack, if you can, thank you. What is your position now? Are you conceding that we should get to the merits?
I'm saying that the court, when looking at the merits, we'll find that the only thing that they can do is affirm that summary judgment.
Okay, but the argument that we are, that this is somehow not preserved, it sounds to me like you're not making that argument. You're conceding that the issue of summary judgment is preserved and we should look at the merits of the summary judgment decision.
I think that's appropriate.
Okay, thank you.
On the summary judgment, when we're looking at the breach of fiduciary duty claim, that's the claim that was brought in the underlying case, the original argument that was presented by the appellants doesn't contain citations to the record that establish where there's a genuine issue of material fact. The assertions that are made in that brief are not substantiated. There's no pointing to depositional testimony, and none of that material was pointed to in this new brief that was put before this court. The appellants don't state what it is that the judge got wrong in terms of the facts or what the judge got wrong in terms of the law. Neither one of those was brought up in the motion for new trial, and neither one of those issues is presented to this court. There's no explanation for how the court made a mistake or what new evidence.
Mr. Storm, Mr. Mack argued to us a few minutes ago that your clients were obligated to consult with Norma Nelson as with respect to the disposition of her assets, the home and other the business and other assets that weren't specifically devised in her will. How do you respond to that argument?
When they're given power of attorney under the statute, they're given the authority to make financial decisions as if they were Norma Nelson. Whether they consulted Norma Nelson or not was something that was never explored in the lower case. There was no questions about whether they spoke to her when they made decisions or not. I would note that in 2015, Lawrence Nelson specifically petitioned that a guardian be appointed for Norma. That individual's name is Betty Christensen. Betty Christensen was made aware of any decisions that were made by Robert and Lawrence. Betty never intervened, never indicated that there was a problem with the decisions that they made, never made an argument against those decisions that were made. There's no indication that they ever did something contrary to Norma's wishes or her best interests.
Does the case law suggest that the duty of someone who is an attorney, in fact, is different if there is a guardian involved or if the person for whom they're exercising the power of attorney is subject to guardianship to a third person?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that what the case law is telling us is that in this context where there's a guardian and they are making decisions under a power of attorney, they're able to make those decisions. The guardian could certainly intervene and say, I'm concerned about this. I'd like an accounting. I'd like an explanation for why this decision was made. And then there could be the opportunity to contest those decisions under that statute by requesting accounting or suggesting that a bad faith decision was made. And that could be litigated, but they're able to make these decisions. With respect to a couple of the arguments that Mr. Mack raised, I want to note that these arguments that he makes, specifically that there should have been some consultation with Norma Nelson, and there's nothing in the record that ever occurred. There was never a deposition demanded by the appellants of Betty Christensen, the guardian. There was never any intervention by Betty Christensen to suggest there was a problem with these. It's fair to say that the decisions that were made in the best interests of Norma Nelson. That's what the lower court determined, because as the court has already noted, Norma Nelson is under care. She has medical bills that need to be paid. Her assets are being used for that purpose. When properties are being disposed, the lower court ruled that there was a good justification for it. It was for the interests of Norma Nelson, and that she had liabilities that needed to be mitigated or reduced, such as the laundromat property, which was found to be a contaminated property that was not up to code and was not turning a profit. The decision to remove liabilities from Norma Nelson's estate would be an appropriate thing to do to ensure that assets are available for Norma Nelson's care. And that's where all of these dispositions went.
As her power, as her attorneys in fact, did your clients, were they required to use their best efforts to effectuate the provisions of Norma Nelson's will?
The question that the statute, I think, creates, 523.21, when it states that the attorneys, in fact, have to act in the best interests of the individual, the determination was it needs to be in the interests of the living person, Norma Nelson, while she's alive, those best interests. To take consideration of making sure that the will gets effectuated in a certain way, unless they're given an instruction that that's what Norma, the living person, wants, then if they have to make a decision between whether an asset's going to be available for inheritance versus used to pay Norma, the living person's bills, it would be appropriate to make that asset available for Norma, the living person, pay those bills. Now, if the will said something to the effect of, I absolutely want my laundromat to go to certain persons, well, that would be an express, clear instruction about what Norma, the living person, wants. Norma, the living person, wants a certain property to wind up in the hands of an individual after she passes away. And if it's possible to maintain that part of the will, if it's possible to fulfill that, then that makes sense that they would keep that in consideration. But the will also says things like the first thing that has to be done is all debts that are owed by me need to be paid. Charitable contributions need to be made. A cabin has to be devised. And then if there's residual is fractioned out in the way that's specified by the will. But otherwise, the first concern for the attorneys, in fact, is, are they paying for Norma's care? I'll note that Mr. Mack, in his brief, he pointed to criminal statutes and noted that if an individual fails to provide for the shelter and the care of a vulnerable individual, they can be criminally liable. That's now, no criminal charge has ever been brought. No criminal investigation has ever taken place. No claim that something criminal was done is ever here. But that's the opposite side of this question of what they should be doing with the assets of Norma. Make sure that her needs are being fulfilled, because one possible penalty is that you could find yourself criminally charged for failing to fulfill that duty.
Mr. Storm, so I don't think there's any disagreement that they needed to act in the best interest of Norma and that they needed to pay her bills. My question to you is why wouldn't it have been reasonable for them, rather than selling assets that would have been devised to appellants, to either sell the cabin, which was worth a lot more, and there certainly would not have been any issue in terms of making those payments that she had to have made, or, as Mr. Mack suggested, taken out a loan so that the devices to all the children would remain consistent with what she had originally intended.
The other properties that were involved in this case, the ones that are considered by the district judge, the judge there notes that each of those properties has some substantial issues with them that made them more a liability than an asset. Each of those was behind on the code, was broken down, posed a risk to the safety of individuals. When making a decision about what to do in the best interest of Norma Nelson, removing liabilities from her estate and also augmenting that estate with financial assets, with liquidating and placing cash in the estate, those are two reasons that would both lean towards it made the most sense for those properties to be the first that are removed. If they were held onto and the cabin was sold, then that money might be used to, be spent on Norma Nelson, but she's also still exposed to liability risks. If somebody gets injured in one of those other properties, then that can become a liability for the estate. It can be a liability for Norma. But in either instance, it creates financial problems for Norma that are more easily avoided if those properties are the ones that are disposed of first. And the district court noted that they were problematic properties and that there'd be considerable investment needed in them in order to make them more valuable. But if they found as-is buyers, that was an appropriate decision to make. Now, in conclusion, the other thing that I'd just like to note is that with the brief that was submitted by Attorney Mack, you'll note that this brief is the same brief, the same core argument comes up in the motion for summary judgment, in the motion for new trial, and then placed in front of this court. The key defect there is that it never offers an explanation for where a mistake was made, for why the discretion of the lower court should be deviated from. The argument is regurgitated, but there's no clarification on what was done wrong. If there's no indication that the lower court made a mistake, it's reasonable for this court to uphold the discretion of the lower court. They considered the record and found that these decisions made sense and summary judgment was appropriate.
Does a district court have discretion when it comes to summary judgment?
When they look at the full record and no one points to a genuine issue of material fact, and the court is then confronted with, well, what does the law say? They interpret the law and say, in this instance, we feel that the law has been upheld, that there's no issue here, that the breach of fiduciary duty did not occur. They've made a conclusion that there's no fact that's relevant, that's material, that raises a dispute. I guess forgive me for the term discretion, that's inappropriate. But their determination was that if there's no genuine issue of material fact raised and it's not the job of the court to go and try and find one, then it's appropriate for them to conclude that summary judgment is appropriate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Storm. Mr. Mack, you have 5 minutes.
Yes. On summary judgment, the duty is on the moving party to show all aspects which entitled it to summary judgment. If I am correct in my claim that Harris v. Gellerman and the cases they're under apply to an attorney in fact as well as a guardian, then it's fairly clear that there is a fiduciary duty on the part of the attorneys in fact to carry out the will of the principal. Now, in this case, there is no evidence of what the principal's will was, and there's no indication from the guardian as to what the principal's will was as to how the property should be disposed of, nor is there any indication.
So if that is true, what are the disputed facts for trial? That's my main question to you, Mr. Mack, is what would a trial look like? What would we ask the jury to decide?
We'd ask the jury to decide whether the defendants in this case manipulated the state under the powers of attorney to preserve for themselves the cabin and to use all the other assets to deprive my clients of their legacies. So I think that's the big issue in this case. The point that I was making just a second ago is that if there's no evidence one way or another as to consultations with the mother, and if there's no evidence one way or the other as to consultations with the guardian, on a summary judgment motion, that duty falls upon the moving party, and the moving party has no such evidence. There are reasons why we brought the motion the way that we did with the issue of a motion for new trial, because we were wondering whether there was anything in the record with regard to Paul Nelson, which would be relevant to making a new trial. We didn't find it, but that's why we did what we did. We weren't trying to be weird. Finally,
a joint motion on behalf of Paul Nelson and your clients, with Paul Nelson only, I guess, challenging the award of costs.
Well, no, he was also challenging the sale of the business and his rights with regard to that business. And we thought there might be some information that came up in that trial that would boost my client's claim. For example, he was going to be testifying at some length. Now, this didn't happen, but that is why we did what we did. I have nothing further.
All right, I don't think there are any other questions. All right. Again, thank you for your briefing and your arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory deadline.